Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back to Reclaiming the Republic, and I am G.R. Mobley, as you already heard. As you can tell, we're diving into the militia, martial law, and those types of things. And as we were leaving, I realized there was a little nugget I wanted to point out from Mr. Henry. Now, Mr. Henry was speaking in a universal case and not complaining or so forth. And I think he made some salient points. And so we're going to read that because we want everybody to understand the requirement of executing the laws of the Union. Now, as you know, the show is sponsored by RepublicReview.org, and you are listening to the only show that gives you the academic evidence as well as the academic-based evidence solution, or the evidence, the academic evidence-based solutions. Yeah, I got that right. Anyway, got a comment line, 425-270-5416. Now that we're talking about the militia, let me take a quick aside, or my little monologue, and let you understand that the militia is a constitutional entity that still exists. And who is that? That's you. That's me. And based on Congress, because Congress has the responsibility of setting standards and discipline and so forth, based on how Congress has redefined the war combatants and so forth, which they have the power to do, they have basically made it so that women would be a part of the armed forces. Now, we still don't have women as the select draft, or I should say we don't have women as required to register to, you know, serve. However, the militia, and I believe the militias do allow the women to serve. Some militias are kind of resistant in allowing women to get into combat roles and so forth. But anyway, I just want you to understand that it's not just limited, and women don't necessarily have to be trigger pullers, and not everybody in the Marine Corps pulls triggers. I mean, every Marine is a rifleman. But when we go to war, it's not every Marine is down in the trench, because somebody's got to be maintaining the supply. Somebody's got to keep those airplanes moving. Somebody's got to keep the fuel going. There are lots of jobs that aren't necessarily trigger-pulling jobs. And as a matter of fact, not the majority of the jobs are trigger-pulling jobs. So just so you understand, we have a lot of people that need to be involved that don't necessarily have to be the person, you know, hiding in the dirt, letting bugs crawl on you and, you know, having a good old time in the rain or the snow or what, and being outdoors and just having fun outside, right? It's not all that. We need people to start creating First Amendment petitions. We need people to start educating people on common law grand juries and First Amendment petitions and the Constitution. So what we need to do, we have all of these different local, you know, grassroots organizations. You want to know what your real grassroots organization is? Your militia, the unorganized militia of your county. So you need to start teaching people. We need to start working hand in hand with those people who are trying to have a militia. Go out there, help them develop and build a constitutional county. We're going to get into this in more detail as we've kind of delineated this over the past several months with the National Liberty Alliance. The ideal constitutional county is where you have a sheriff that actually wakes up and appoints a militia for the county and actually has an organized, unorganized militia. In other words, they know who the people are that are in the militia as well as the unorganized militia. Now, that most people think, well, that's everybody else, right? No. Yes, it does, but it doesn't mean that you're excluded if you're not in the organized militia. They don't need everybody. As a matter of fact, there are quotas. And so the quotas is based on how many people are in that county. And we'll get into that, and Madison will talk about this, because everything in this constitutional republic boils down to the counties. I want you to understand that. The counties were the integral sub-element of government. And look at how our states have completely marginalized our county government. They have centralized all powers of the state because they're that power-hungry. Just pointing out the reality, my friends, because we're going to get into, we've already proven how the counties have been integral with apportionment, representation, as well as statehood. When the states are to be created, the counties are already existing, and they're the ones that end up creating the Constitution. Don't let anybody tell you otherwise. So, it wasn't a bunch of people that just got together throughout the geographical region of the state. No, the states were actually organized by counties. Anywho, we want to welcome you aboard. Thanks for listening. And what we want to do is we want to dive straight into what Mr. Henry says about every man be armed. And he says, may we not discipline and arm them as well as Congress if the power be concurrent? So that our militia shall have two sets of arms, double sets of regimentals, etc., and thus at every great cost we shall be doubly armed. The great object is that every man be armed. But can the people afford to pay for double sets of arms and etc.? Everyone who is able to have a gun. But we have learned by experience that necessary as it is to have arms, and though our assembly has, by a succession of laws for many years, endeavored to have the militia completely armed, it is still far from being the case. When this power is given up to Congress without limitation or bounds, how will your militia be afraid? You trust to chance? For sure, I am not that nation which shall trust its liberties in other hands cannot long exist. If gentlemen are serious when they suppose a concurrent power can be the impolicy to amend it, or, in other words, to say that Congress shall not arm or discipline them till the states shall have refused or neglected to do it. This is my object. I wish to bring it to what they themselves say is implied. Implication is to the foundation of our civil liberties. And when you speak of arming the militia by a concurrence of power, you use implication. But implication will not save you when a strong army of veterans come upon you. You would be laughed at by the whole world for trusting your safety in implicity to implication. Okay, or implication. So he's making a really good point that the states do have this big responsibility. But Mason was right when you look at how the federal government downplayed the militia so much after the War of 1812. You know, as things progressed from Madison ending the Revolutionary War. Yes, Madison ended the Revolutionary War because it was finally a treaty. The Treaty of Ghent was finally a treaty that Britain honored, and they stopped impressing our sailors and stealing our cargo and so forth. So as we moved forward, we really didn't have a huge threat of being taken over. So the concept was, well, you know what, we really don't seem to have enemies that are coming after us, and so Congress let it go, and they let it go by intention. And as we look through the time of, you know, moving towards the Civil War, you know, we didn't seem to have any, not that we were threatened by somebody coming to invade us. And so they literally ignored the militia, and the states at that point in time were ignoring it as well, thinking maybe that the federal government should be doing it, but they should have realized that they weren't. Either way, the states should have been poking the federal government in the eye and saying, hey, you have the responsibility of funding the arming and the training, as Mason had pointed out, and held them accountable to that. Then when Lincoln wanted to execute the Civil War, you know, it wouldn't have created a huge, let me just say, a huge vigor of activity and fighting in the ranks of the militia, because bottom line, the Northern men didn't care to go force these slave owners to come back into the Union. They were happy they were gone. They found that practice reprehensible. But, like I said in my previous episode, had Lincoln let the South secede and basically come out and say, we're going to end slavery in the Western Hemisphere, and we're going to start with our Southern friends, our Southern neighbors, then gone and ended that. But see, Lincoln was a man of failure. He failed so much that he was more afraid of failing as president than he was at doing the right thing. And so I hate to be the judge of Lincoln, you know, but when we look at what he did and how he did it, yeah, I'm armchair quarterbacking. And the fact of the matter is, things would have been very different had he gone down that path, because then after the Civil War, I think the states would have wanted to come back into the Union, and I believe that there would have been less animosity and probably more, because the Southern states still wanted to maintain slavery. They left because of slavery. But anyway, we will be right back after these two promos. Thank you so much.
If you run a business or an organization, you already know email is an essential tool for communicating. If you're interested in reducing your overhead and increasing your productivity, I personally recommend you look into AdLocal email marketing services. AdLocal has a special offer for my listeners with email services that start at $10 a month for your first 1,000 addresses. If you want to increase customer retention, grow your market presence, track your statistics, and improve your engagement with your customers with modern, elegant emails that express the personality of your business with emails that integrate with your website, you need to contact AdLocal, and they handle the rest. Take it from me. AdLocal offers the best solutions for all organization sizes, and they lead with their pricing and the 24-hour customer service. Folks, it's time to call AdLocal at 866-88-ADLOCAL or visit them on the web at www.adlocal.com.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416.
Okay, so next up, we have, after Mr. Henry just made this comment about every man be armed, and makes a good point that the states should have been more active because it was in their best interest as well to hold the federal government accountable in maintaining the militia. But, you know, everybody was getting jobs and becoming rich because they didn't have to worry about the defense because there was no threat. Anyway, that's what happens when nations kind of turn their back on the responsibility of guarding themselves and protecting themselves. Anyway, Mr. Nicholas starts off with martial law and then goes into some comments on the militia. And this is what he says. But his great uneasiness is that the militia may be under martial law when not on duty. A little attention will be sufficient to remove this apprehension. The Congress is to have the power, quote, to provide for arming, organizing, and disciplining the militia, and for governing such part of them as may be employed in the service of the United States, close quote. Another part tells you that they are to provide for calling forth to execute the laws of the Union. That's in Article 1, Section 8, Subsection 15. Suppress insurrections and repel invasions. These powers only amount to this, that they can only call them forth in three cases, and that they can only govern such part of them as may be in the actual service of the United States. In other words, they can't call them forth for natural disasters. This cause is sufficient or for pandemics or for anything like that. This cause is sufficient security that they will not be under martial law, but when in actual service. If, sir, a mutiny bill has continued since the Revolution, and he's pointing out under the Articles of Confederation that this mutiny bill has continued since the Revolution, recollect that this is done under the present happy government, the Articles of Confederation. Under the new government, under this new constitution, and that's how they were referring to it in the Virginia ratification debates, as this new government, no approbation of money is to the use of raising or supporting an army shall be for longer term than 2 years. The president is to command, but the regulation of the army and navy is given to Congress. Our representatives will be a powerful check here. The influence of the Commons in England in this case is very predominant, but the worthy member on the other side of the House has said that the militia are the great bulwark of the nation and wishes to take no step to bring them to disuse. What is the inference? He wishes to see the militia employed? The Constitution provides what he wants. This is to bring them frequently into use, if he expects that by depriving the general government of the power of calling them into more frequent use, they will be rendered more useful and expert. He is greatly deceived. He ought to part with the power to use the militia to somebody to whom ought we want not to part with for the general defense. If you give it not to Congress, it may be denied by the states. If you withhold it, you render a standing army absolutely necessary. For if they have no militia, they must have such a body of troops as to be necessary for the defense of the Union. That is their job. But the bottom line is, they would be violating the Constitution unless they amended the Constitution, because they can't create a standing army and they can't create this army defense without amending the Constitution. In other words, if they wanted to create a National Guard and change its structure from a county throughout the state to strictly state regulatory use, then that's what they should have done. They should have amended the Constitution, but because they didn't, the National Guard is unconstitutional. Because each county was supposed to have requisites or requirements of manning for that part of the state, as we will find when Madison talks about this a little bit later. It was said by the gentleman that there was something singular in this government in saying that the militia can be called forth to execute the laws of the Union. This is, again, Mr. Nicholas. It's just continuing. There is a great difference between having the power in three cases and in all cases. They cannot call them forth for any purpose than to execute the law, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions. And can anything be more demonstrably obvious than that the laws ought to be enforced if resisted, and insurrections quelled, and foreign invasions repelled, like we have today? Who's to do it? The militia. And look, we are underrun and under siege, counting well over 40 million invaders in our country already. Well, what do we do about it? Well, the Constitution tells Congress exactly what there's to do, and they have ignored their job. This is why I say that we, you know, I'm trying to get Bob Schultz to actually move forward with a petition calling Congress to either execute their job or to step down because they're disqualified. And if they don't do that, then we sue them in court, and let's take it all the way up to the Supreme Court to say, Supreme Court, you need to get rid of all of Congress, because not one member of Congress has called to do their job based on supporting the Constitution. Therefore, they have become disqualified for failing to support the Constitution, as they've taken an oath to do so. See, this is where ignorance of the Constitution really steps in. You need to see that video on immigration on Reclaiming the Republic YouTube channel. You just go to reclaimingtherepublic.org. We have the link to our YouTube channel right there. But it is asked, why has not the Constitution declared that the civil power shall be employed to execute the laws? Has it said that the civil power shall not be employed? The civil officer is to execute the laws on all occasions. And if he be resisted, this auxiliary power is given to Congress of calling forth the militia to execute them when it shall be found absolutely necessary. Now, Mr. Madison then steps up, and then Mr. Henry Madison and so forth. And I'm going to kind of skip over a lot of this stuff. And now Mr. Lee of Westmoreland. And this is, again, this is all talking about the militia. Remember, this is all on, Saturday the 15th, June 15th. It kind of warmed up, I think, on the 13th, then got really hot on the 14th and the 15th. I mean, this part of the ratification debates was very, very focused on martial law, on the militia, the defense, and the enforcements, and all of these things, and supposed amendments to the Constitution. And this is what Mr. Lee of Westmoreland says. But says he, the creature destroys the creator. How has he proved it? But his bare assertion. By ascribing infinitude of to powers clearly limited and defined for certain designated purposes. I shall find not repeat the arguments which have already fully refuted this idea of the honorable gentleman. But gentlemen say that we must apply the militia to execute the constitutional laws without the interposition of the civil power, and that the military officer is to be substituted for the sheriff in all cases. This is unwarrantable objection is urged, like many others, to produce the rejection of this government, though contrary to reason. What is the meaning of this clause under debate? Does not their explanation violate the natural meaning of language? Is it to be inferred that when the laws are not opposed, judgments must be executed by the militia? Now, when laws are not opposed, judgments must be executed by the militia. Is this the right and liberal way of discussing the general national objects? I am astonished that the gentleman should attempt to impose so absurd a construction upon us. The honorable gentleman last up, which was Mr. Mason, says that the organizing the militia gives Congress power to punish them when not in the actual service of the government. The gentleman is mistaken in meaning the word organization to complain, which would unnecessarily take up time. Suffice it to say, it does not include the infliction of punishments. The militia will be subject to the common regulations of war when in actual service, but not in peacetime. But the honorable gentleman said that there is a danger of an abuse of power and attempted to exemplify, and delegated power may be abused. It would be civil and candid in those gentlemen who inveigh against this Constitution with such malignity to show in what manner adequate powers can be given without possibility of being abased. It appears to me to be as well secured as it can be, and that the alteration he proposes would involve more disadvantages, I cannot then conclude that this government will, in my opinion, secure our liberty and happiness without any alteration. Now, Mr. Clay, of course, like Bloodworth, you know, just gets up and wants to know, hey, you know, what is this? And it goes back and forth between Madison and him. And I think when he talks about what is an insurrection, or, you know, when is it that they would need to help, you know, the sheriff? And Madison uses the word riot. When they start to riot, the militia could be called forth if the sheriff does not have the adequate, you know, manpower. Anyway, we will be back with Mr. Henry on the 16th regarding common law and finding his quip on this right after these two promos. Folks, as you know, online fraud is on the rise, and it's more important than ever for your new and existing customers to be able to determine whether they are using a website with a secured connection. If you didn't know, Google mandated in 2017 that all data submitted to its linked websites must be secure with SSL certificates. Without SSL certificates, your site is listed by Google as not secure. In other words, without these certificates, your site will be harder to find, and this will impact new traffic and ultimately your revenue. Whether you're a blogger or in e-commerce, AdLocal will help protect your website from all forms of data breaches, phishing scams, and build a secure environment for your businesses, big or small. Contact AdLocal by calling 866-88-ADLOCAL or visit them on the web at www.adlocal.com for custom pricing. To become a citizen, one must take an oath to support and defend the Constitution. Those of us who are naturally born citizens are obligated and duty-bound to fulfill the same oath, even though we're not required to take it, because it is implied upon us at birth. This is why I cannot emphasize enough the importance in supporting businesses who are supporting our Constitution. We have to stop supporting businesses that have chosen to hide behind political correctness, and obviously we must stop supporting progressive businesses who are working to undermine our republic and our Constitution. Do not let businesses or organizations convince you that they are supporting the Constitution by supporting protests for social justice. By definition, social justice is the distribution of wealth, opportunities, and privileges within a society. In other words, they're calling for socialism, which is incompatible with individual liberty and individual sovereignty and our Constitution. With that, please consider supporting businesses who advertise on this show and this radio station. Don't forget, you can call our 24-hour comment line to ask a question or to speak on any topic. Dial 4225-270-5416. Okay, so I'll get into it because I was just talking about it. Here's Mr. Clay, and he asks the instances where an opposition to the laws did not come within the idea of an insurrection. And Mr. Madison replied that a riot did not come within the legal definition of an insurrection. There might be riots to oppose the execution of the laws, which the civil power might not be sufficient to quell. This was one case, and there were probably other cases. He referred to the candor of the committee, whether the militia could be used to destroy themselves. And so, one thing he points out here is that when they're having a riot, they're not necessarily, trying to destroy the union. And as a matter of fact, a case in point, right after they created this government in 1792, there was this thing called the Whiskey Rebellion. It wasn't a rebellion to overthrow the government. It wasn't necessarily a true insurrection, but it was a repelling and refusal to pay these new taxes on libations, or I should say liquor tax. And so the Whiskey Rebellion, which happened in western Pennsylvania, required that the federal government called upon Pennsylvania, Maryland, New Jersey, and Virginia to bring forth a militia to, go out there, and Washington went out there with Hamilton and the militia. They federalized them, and they went out there to arrest, and they arrested 24 men. And two of those 24, they were all charged with treason, and two of those 24 men were actually convicted with treason. Now, Washington pardoned them, but the fact of the matter is, this wasn't an insurrection. This was like a protest, like what we see in Portland or what we've been seeing in Minneapolis and around the nation. Now, when I say this protest, I'm not talking about the January 6th. You know, that was not necessarily a protest. That was in no way the magnitude of what we have seen by these communists. This is a communist Bolshevik revolution, what we're seeing in the streets throughout these different cities. What happened in D.C. was really something that was more orchestrated and something that just, you know, was concocted. You could tell that all of a sudden, you know, people, there was a small set of people who chose to actually, you know, break away from the civil protest and actually start violating the laws, which then all of a sudden caught up a lot of other people. Oh, let's go inside. Okay, we're going to, you got to remember that the Constitution gives us a right to basically petition government. We have a right to get in front of government and petition them for the redress of grievances. How is that done today with fences around our government? We're being denied our rights of what by what they are doing. Anyway, I don't want to go on and on and on, but Mr. Henry, who does like to go on and on, I want to just read this one little quip. The honorable gentleman said that the militia should be called forth to quell riots. Now he's pointing at Madison. Have we not seen this business go on very well today without military force? It is not long established principle of the common law of England that civil force is sufficient to quell riots. Well, what about, so, you know, Mr. Henry can put it in his pipe and smoke the fact that down the road in 1792 with the Whiskey Rebellion, they weren't able to do it. And they weren't going to do it because they kind of all agreed that they weren't going to pay this whiskey tax. And there were people that lost their homes. There were people that were injured. I think that there may have even been some deaths by these riots. Fact of the matter, these men were arrested for treason and two were convicted. Okay? So, moving on, we kind of want to get into exclusive legislation. Now, this is really important that we kind of go through the hyperbole, because Mason is really good at using hyperbolic speech and rhetoric. And so this is where Mason starts talking about exclusive legislation. And he says this, that there are few clauses in the Constitution so dangerous as that which gave Congress exclusive. Now, this is what he is saying. Now, listen. Exclusive power of legislation within 10 mile square. And I got into an argument with A. Ralph Epperson that this clause means that Congress can have legislation for the entire nation, that they have been able to subvert this absolute definition. Here is the anti-federalist George Mason even call it to the limitations that legislation within the 10 miles, not throughout the nation. Implication, he observed, that going on with what Mr. Mason is saying, implication, he observed, was capable of any extension that would probably be extended to the augment the congressional powers. But here there was no need of implication. This cause gave them unlimited authority in every possible case within that district. Again, he qualified it within the district, not throughout the nation. This 10-mile square, says Mr. Mason, may be set at defiance the laws of the surrounding states and may, like the custom of the superstitious days of our ancestors, become the sanctuary of the blackest crimes. Here the federal courts are to sit. We have heard a good deal of said about justice. Now, yeah, it's kind of interesting how we see in these days how, you know, the pedophile ring and everything else seems, and it doesn't seem like there's anybody being brought to justice within D.C., but there's implications that it's going on. Interesting, right? But, you know, so Mason was kind of right that if Congress became corrupt, they would, you know, allow these things or they would dictate these things. But here's the bigger point. The bigger point is this, that Congress has the exclusive legislation for the District of Columbia. Did they say anywhere in here that they would create their own little government, their own mayor? Because when you create a mayor and city council, then you basically bestow the legislative authority, the sovereignty of that land to those who are now going to govern it in that capacity. Well, it's clear. Congress cannot abdicate their responsibility. They must actually be the ones that dictate those laws. Period. If they don't want to do that, they have to amend the Constitution, which basically forces the federal government from ever allowing Washington, D.C. to become a state. It is for them to control so that they do not become subjects. And Madison's going to get into this because this is Madison's response to Mr. Mason. And he says this. Mr. Chairman, I did conceive, sir, that the clause under consideration was one of those parts which would speak its own praise. It is hardly necessary to say anything concerning it. Strike it out of the system, and let me ask whether there would be not much larger scope for those dangers. I cannot comprehend the power of legislating over a small district which cannot exceed 10 miles square. And may not be more than 1 mile. Okay, so in other words, 1 mile, 10 miles square and not 1 mile more. I think that's what he meant to say, but they talked different back then. Will involve the dangers which he apprehends. If there be any knowledge in my mind of the nature of man, I should think it would be the last thing that would enter into the mind of any man to great exclusive advantages in very subscribed district, to the prejudice of the community at large. We make suppositions and afterwards deduce conclusions from them, as if they were established axioms. But, after all, bring home this question to ourselves. Is it probable that the members from Georgia, New Hampshire, etc. will concur to sacrifice the privileges of their friends? I believe that whatever state may become the seat of government, it may be the object of the jealousy and envy of the other states. Let me remark, if not already remarked, that there must be a secession by particular states of the district to Congress. Now, at this point in time, they had no idea where this 10-mile square was going to be. And so, if I remember correctly, they set up government in Washington, D.C., and then they moved it to Philadelphia. And then, you know, and by that time, they had already decided that it was going to be a half split on the Potomac between Maryland and Virginia. Now, Virginia is no longer offering the, you know, that portion of land to, somehow they took it back to the District of Columbia. This is where the Pentagon sits. This is where sits some intelligence agencies. You know, Langley, you know, the CIA headquarters and some of these other places are actually in Virginia soil. And so the intent was to keep these places or keep, you know, the District of Columbia from being harassed by state government, city government, and so forth. But anyway, we will come back to Madison's remarks right after these two promos. So please stay tuned, and we'll be right back after this. Thank you so much.
I've been on the radio for a couple of years, and for over a decade, I have been providing content to help patriots understand what has to be done if we're going to save our Constitution and our Republic. Not one academic has been able to refute my argument for Republic Review, and even most conservative entertainers will not support Republic Review due to self-interest reasons. If you have not read my bullet point descriptions and executive summaries, you need to so that you can understand what we all need to do. I'm trying to give patriots the necessary knowledge to take back our Constitution and Republic. Go to reclaimingtherepublic.org so you can read my bullet points and view the Republic Review flowchart. You can even order my executive summaries, books, and other content to understand the simplicity of what we have to do. This way, you will know what, why, and how to support the reclaiming of our Republic. Again, please take a look at my content on reclaimingtherepublic.org so you can become a part of the solution. To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires 2/3 of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so as basically Mr. Madison kind of goes on and he kind of identifies, you know, all of these things that, you know, would just be kind of ludicrous in allowing these things to move forward, let me just kind of repeat, and I'll go back to the beginning because we just started Madison's comments. And he says, Mr. Chairman, I did conceive that the clause under consideration was one of the most parts which would speak to its own praise. It is hardly necessary to say anything concerning it. Strike it out of the system, and let me ask whether there would not be much larger scope for those dangers. I cannot comprehend the power of legislating over a small district which cannot exceed 10 nautical miles and may not be 1 mile more will involve the dangers he apprehends. If there be any knowledge in my mind of the nature of man, I should think it would be the last thing that would enter into the mind of any man to grant exclusive advantages in very circumscribed districts to the prejudice of the community at large. We make suppositions and afterwards deduce conclusions from them as if they were established axioms. But, after all, bring home this question to ourselves. Is it probable that the members of Georgia, New Hampshire, and etc. will concur to the sacrifice privileges of friends? I believe that whatever state may become the seat of government, it will become the object of the jealousy and the envy of the other states. Let me remark, if not already remarked, that there must be a secession by particular states of the District of Congress, and that the states may settle the terms of the session. The states may make what stipulation they please in it, and if they apprehend any danger, they may refuse it altogether. How could the general government be guarded from the undue influence of particular states or from insults without such exclusive power? If it were the pleasure of a particular state to control the session and the deliberations of Congress, would they be secure from the insults or the influence of such a state? If this Commonwealth depended for the freedom of deliberation on the laws of any state where were it necessary to sit, would it not be liable to the attacks of that nature and with the more indignity which have been already offered to Congress?
With respect to the government of Holland, I believe the States General have no jurisdiction over The Hague, but I have heard that mentioned as a circumstance which gave undue inference to Holland over the rest. We must limit our apprehensions to certain degrees of probability. The evils which they urge must result from this clause are extremely improbable, nay, almost impossible. Now, Mr. Nicholas pipes up, and this is what he says. He insisted that as the state within each 10-mile square might be, could prescribe the terms on which Congress should hold it, no danger could arise, as no state would consent to injure itself. There was the same security with respect to the places purchased for the erection of forts, magazines, and etc. And as the territory of the United States, the power of Congress only extended to make needful rules and regulations concerning it without prejudicing the claim of any particular state. The right of territory not being given up, but the grant of those lands to the United States was for the general benefit of all the states and not to be perverted to their prejudice. Now, you understand what he's saying, that the territories are for the general benefit of all the states, not for the advantage of the general government. That consequently, whether that country were formed into new states or not, the danger apprehended could not take place, that the seat of government was still to be part of the state, and as to the general regulations was to be considered as such. Now, Mr. Madison goes on, and actually I think is that, yep, Mr. Pendleton actually talks. My mistake here. So Mr. Pendleton basically says, Mr. Chairman, this clause does not give Congress power to impede the operation of any of the Constitution or to make any regulation that may affect the interest of the citizens of the Union at large. But it gives them power over the local police of the place so it has to be secured from any interpretation into their proceedings. Notwithstanding the violent attack upon it, I believe, sir, this is the fair construction of the clause. It gives them power of exclusive legislation in any case within that district. What is the meaning of this? What is it supposed to? Is it opposed to the general powers of the federal legislature or to those of the state legislatures? I understand it as opposed to the legislative power of that state where it shall be. What then is the power? It is that Congress shall exclusively legislate there in order to preserve the police of this place and their own personal independence, that they may not be overawed or insulted, and of course to preserve them in opposition to any attempt by the state where it shall be. This is the fair construction. Can we suppose that in order to effect these salutary ends, Congress will make it an asylum for villains and the vilest creatures of all parts of the world? Well, that's what's happened, but not by abiding by the Constitution. Anyway, because they've already given up their legislative power and have allowed a corrupt government to be put in place with a mayor and council. Anyway, will it not degrade their own dignity to make it a sanctuary for villains? I hope that no man that will ever compose that Congress will associate with the most prolific characters. Why oppose this power? Suppose it was contrary to the sense of their constituents to grant exclusive privileges to citizens residing within that place. The effect would be directly in opposition to what he says. It could have no operation without the limits of that district. Were Congress to make a law granting them an exclusive privilege of trading to the East Indies, it could have no effect the moment it would go without that place, for their exclusive power is confined to that district. See, they're spelling it all out for you, friends. They're actually telling you how defined and how limited this power is, but it's Congress's, not any other polity, such as the city of D.C. Were they to pass such a law, it would be nugatory, and every member of the community at large would trade to the East Indies as well as the citizens of that district. This exclusive power is limited to that place solely for their own preservation, which all gentlemen allow to be necessary. Now, so I guess one of the things he's kind of pointing out is that they could create an advantage to where, you know, because they could make a trade treaty with India and all these other places, that they could basically get India and these other trade treaties that they've established to give them, you know, goods at much cheaper than cost. Well, those goods could only be much cheaper at cost, like he's pointing out there, because as those goods leave the District of Columbia and come into the neighboring states, such as Maryland and Virginia, then those states would be able to assign duties to those that all of the rest of the states have basically had to pay. So there's those goods could only be consumed and kept in that district, because where do these laws of imposts come from? They come from the federal government, and they must be applied on everything entering into the states. So they cannot ignore those imposts. They may be able to enjoy the benefits, but if a congressman tried to if a congressman tries to sneak these goods home, then they would be subject to those same imposts, and the state could ensure that those imposts are applied. That's the way it should go. Anyway, I hope you're finding this dialogue regarding the potential establishment of Washington, D.C. as a state so that you understand there's just no way it can be a state. It's just no way. Anyway, George Mason then steps up, and he basically comes up and says this: "Mr. Chairman, gentlemen say there is no power given by this clause. Is there anything in this Constitution which secures to the state the powers which are said to be retained? Will powers remain to the states which are not expressly guarded and reserved? I will suppose a case. Gentlemen may call it impossible, and suppose that Congress will act with wisdom and integrity. Among the enumerated powers, Congress are to lay taxes, duties and imposts, and excises, and to pay the debts and provide for the general welfare and common defense. And by that clause, so often the sweeping clause, the necessary and proper, they are to make all clause necessary to execute those laws. Now, suppose operations should arise under this government, and any writer should dare to stand forth and expose to the community at large the abuses of these powers. Could not Congress, under the idea of providing for the general welfare and under their own construction, say that this was destroying the general peace and encouraging sedition and poisoning the minds of the people? And could they not, in order to provide against this, lay a dangerous restriction on the press?" Now, remember what everybody had said regarding the jurisdiction. If they say that they're going, well, now we're going to reread this, because this is really good. And this is a really good point, because he's talking about something that is not enumerated and how Congress is now reaching into something that they have no enumerated powers over, such as the press. And it was already addressed. But anyway, we will be back in our next episode with more of this great stuff. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. Have you taken the time to watch our presentation on YouTube that provided an irrefutable argument of what we have to do to save our Constitution and our Republic? I know it's over an hour and 30 minutes, but you only need to watch the first 30 minutes. If you take the time to watch this presentation, I promise it will change your paradigm regarding what our Constitution is and what we have to do if we are going to save it, our liberties, our sovereignty, and our republic. We already have answers to most of the questions that you might think of after watching this presentation, and we want to help you get to a point where you have a profound understanding of the audit and republic review process. This is why our bullet overview and flowchart of both the argument and process is available on reclaimingtherepublic.org. The sooner you get informed, the sooner you can get involved and make an impact. So go to reclaimingtherepublic.org.
www.takeactionpod.org to the Take Action page. That's where you'll find the video. Thank you so much.